Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. Last week, House Republicans voted to cut $1.1 billion from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which funds more than 1,500 public TV and radio stations across the country. The final vote was 214 to 212. 214 Republicans voted for the bill, 4 opposed, and 2 did not vote. 2 Republicans changed their vote from no to yes to push the bill over the line. 208 Democrats voted against the bill, 4 did not vote. Now it's up to Senate Republicans to determine whether the bill passes. They only need a majority to vote yes. We'll discuss this later in the show with KALW's Executive Director, James Cass. We'll begin today's show by discussing media coverage of this political moment. Do you think the media are meeting this moment? There's so much going on. Israel's ongoing assault on Gaza, Israel attacking Iran and Iran retaliating, unprecedented ICE raids across the country, a political assassination targeting Democrats in Minnesota, and Republicans seeking to slash social service programs. Today, we're joined by two guests. Craig Aaron is the president and CEO of Free Press and the Free Press Action Fund. They work to change media and technology policy, promote the public interest, and strengthen democracy. Hi, Craig. Thanks for joining us again.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me back, Rose.
Will Bunch is an award-winning journalist and national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Will Bunch has written several books on politics, including his most recent After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. Hi, Will. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Hey, Rose. Thanks so much for having me back on. I really appreciate it.
Well, great to have you. I want to ask you both a big question, but you follow media very, very closely. There's so much going on right now. Will, what do you think about how media and journalists are meeting this moment? Do you think they're doing a good job overall?
Well, you know, it's such a broad question, right? Because I always feel the media in a way is like a Major League Baseball team, right? Which is the whole team can be doing kind of badly, but one of the players could be hitting 400 or other way around, or the team could win 12 games in a row, but somebody's batting 100 during that streak. Because, you know, from my point of view, this is the moment that, you know, 50 years ago, I decided I wanted to be a journalist, was to cover a moment like this. Right. And there are definitely people out there who are rising up to meet the occasion. A lot of them are like independent journalists. They're not maybe with the big mainstream organizations, but with everything that's going on in terms of, you know, like DOGE and what's happening to federal workers and those sorts of things, they're doing a great job. But I do think the elite mainstream media is still floundering about, basically. You know, I've seen so many stories lately where it's either, you know, both sides are to blame for a certain problem when it's really not both sides, it's really one side, or just like naivete about Trump and what his real agenda is. I mean, just an example of the both sides situation was last weekend's horrific news out of Minnesota, where you had this political assassination of a state lawmaker and an attempt on another lawmaker and their spouses. And obviously this triggered, you know, a lot of coverage about the rising problem of political violence in this country, which is for sure is happening, and for sure it's a big problem. But, you know, study after study has shown that the majority of, you know, domestic terrorism type violence over the last 20 or 30 years is coming from the right and not from the left. And yet, you know, the New York Times and other elite organizations continue to portray it as a both sides problem. So that That's disturbing. I mean, just real quickly, I mean, this is a moment of rising authoritarianism, and if any time screamed out for a free press trying to do its job and stand up for democracy, it's now, and it's been underwhelming so far.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about media coverage of that horrific political violence that happened in Minnesota a little bit later in the show. What are your thoughts, Craig? I know it is a big question. You've got independent media, you have broadcast media, public radio, but overall, what are your thoughts on media coverage? Do you think reporters are meeting this moment and letting people know what's at stake?
Well, I tend to be in a lot of alignment with the Bryce Harper of Philadelphia journalism, Will Bunch here, in that there's some very good individual work happening, incredible investigative reporting, a lot of specific examples of journalism that are really outstanding and are doing what journalists are supposed to do, exposing what's happening behind closed doors that those of us in the public wouldn't know about otherwise. But the larger questions of framing, the ability to confront rising authoritarianism, expose the larger agenda, not fall back on both sidesism and kind of horse race coverage, just sort of vote counting kind of coverage when so much is at stake. I think that's where the media continues to really struggle with that larger perspective and really with confronting this onslaught. And it's hard for all of us individually. There's such a fire hose of information and so many terrible things happening at once. It can be hard to hold all of that together. But I think where the media has struggled is to provide very often that larger context, really expose the larger agendas to not just fall in to the personalities and who's up and who's down, but actually look at the kind of structures that are being demolished and destroyed. And often, also, when we're talking about things at scale, like you started talking about this rescission package, which among other things is slashing funding for public media and our ability to get some of those good stories. But the other $8 billion or so in that package is cutting global health funding for, helping people with HIV/AIDS and malaria and other diseases all around the world. So this is literally a bill that is going to cause thousands and thousands and thousands of deaths. And it's very hard for the media to capture the scope and scale and real deep risk of what's going on while also trying to cover sort of a legislative fight. And I think that requires new tools, that requires new approaches, that requires really stepping back and recognizing that we are in a different moment that doesn't look like all the moments that came before, that we're no longer simply playing on, oh, who's up, who's down, who's going to gain seats in the next election, that there's a larger project at work that is really dismantling so much of our democratic infrastructure and just blowing past any kind of norms. And a journalism that meets that moment looks different than the one, or needs to look different than the one that came before.
To your point, Craig, I just want to give praise to the New York Times' Stephanie Nolan, who had really a devastating but very important piece a couple days ago. South Africa built a medical research powerhouse. Trump cuts have demolished it. South Africa has for decades been a medical research powerhouse, she writes, yet its stature has been little known to people outside the field. Scientists have been responsible for key breakthroughs against major global killers, including heart disease, HIV, and respiratory viruses such as COVID. They've worked very closely with American researchers. They've been awarded with more funding from the U.S. than any other country has received. And now they're losing their jobs. I mean, it's just devastating. And that was a really good report. I wanted to ask you both about the assassinations that happened last week. I feel like in some ways we're so numb to this kind of violence at this point. But when you stop and think about how this happened, that the alleged shooter, Vance Bolter, dressed up like a police officer and was in a car that looked like a cop car and banged on the door of these Democratic politicians saying he was a police officer, most people would open the door. In fact, the Minnesota, K-A-R-E of Minneapolis, they ran a statement that came from Senator John Hoffman and his wife, Yvette. I mean, this is absolutely horrific. They said around 2 a.m., and their adult daughter was at the home. Luckily, she was there because she called 911. They woke up to someone who identified himself as a police officer pounding on the door. When the man pointed a gun at them, John Hoffman lunged at the gunman and was shot 9 times. His wife, Yvette, was able to close the door, but she was shot 8 times. Their daughter, Hope, secured the lock and called 911. And then, tragically, Minnesota State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband, Mark, were shot in their Brooklyn Park home. They were killed. Democratic Representative Melissa Hortman was a champion for the environment, education, reproductive rights, immigrant rights, and workers. Will, what are your thoughts on this? I almost feel like, you know, 20 years ago, this would have been massive news. We'd still be talking about it. But now it's almost like it happened and we're on to the next shooting. I mean, it's just devastating how this happens in this country.
Yeah, I mean, the news cycle, you're right. I mean, the news cycle has been so crazy the last couple weeks. I mean, this got an okay amount of coverage, but you're right. I think in a different time, it probably would have gotten, who knows, you know, twice as much coverage. I keep thinking about the handcuffing of a U.S. senator, you know, Alex Padilla from California. I mean, that really felt like mostly a one day story, you know, and as you know, when have you ever seen a U.S. senator handcuffed and it just kind of disappeared? And it's just this, you know, tsunami of news. But I did really want to emphasize one point about the Minnesota, and you kind of hinted at it in your reading of that horrific event. And it really dovetails with another big story right now, which is the ICE raids and the way that ICE, or whether it's ICE or Homeland Security or Border Patrol agents, the way that they're comporting themselves on these raids. You know, the fact that ever since Trump came into office, there's this, there's this mode now where they go out on these raids wearing masks, even when it's, you know, 85 degrees out, they're wearing these ski masks. They don't wear any kind of badge. They don't wear any kind of uniform. In fact, they almost go out of their way to wear like the scruffiest clothes possible. And, you know, it, when you see it, you know, it looks like a secret police, you know, that because you don't know what agency they are. There was that incident at Dodger Stadium yesterday in LA. And for hours, people knew there were these federal officers there. People didn't know what agency they were from. They thought they were from ICE, but they were from Border Patrol. And in the Minnesota thing, here you saw a bad guy, an assassin, I think, take advantage of that new world that we're in. And the fact that people don't even know who's a cop, you know, who's a federal agent, who's law enforcement. It's not the only incident we've had. We've had a real spike in people impersonating police officers. And, you know, so it's interesting how these stories are kind of running together. You know, it's just indicative of a more violent, more paranoid, more chaotic society that suddenly we find ourselves living in.
And there are actually stories out there about how to determine whether someone is an actual police officer or authority, because, you know, who wouldn't open their door when someone's banging on it saying, "Police, open up." So this just raises so many questions. And then because we have so many guns in this country, that adds another layer to all of this. Craig, I wonder what your thoughts are on this. Just seeing an increase in political violence in this country. And now under the Trump administration, you have Senator Alex Padilla of California being pushed out of a room as he tries to ask Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem a question. They force him to the ground and then handcuff him. And then there's news out about New York City Comptroller Brad Lander. So he goes to federal immigration courts to observe and to stand up for immigrants who could possibly be deported. He was also arrested. And The Guardian is reporting that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security is now requiring lawmakers, so these are lawmakers, to provide 72 hours of notice before visiting detention centers. This is brand new guidance. I mean, this is unprecedented.
Yeah, it's never existed before. And I think at every level, there's been this onslaught, this concerted effort to, do away with it, make this the new normal, really, to pervade even these places where you might not expect to see this. Not that it's acceptable in other places either, but to really spread that fear, put no one beyond the reach of these masked and unmarked officials, I guess we're calling them. You don't know if it's real or not. It raises, as Will suggests, this opportunity for sort of copycats and people trying that. We've already seen it, people showing up to businesses claiming to be immigration authorities with some outfit they bought on Amazon, to go after people, to extort them, to rob them, whatever the case may be. And you suddenly can't tell the difference because of the way these folks are showing up. And the utter lawlessness of it, the just stark break with morality. I think this is where the media has had such a hard time covering this, and it breaks through sometimes. There's this idea of, well, somebody got deported to an El Salvador in prison, and it was completely the wrong guy. We should do something about that. This administration is even contesting that, right? They start trumping up charges and going after him. We've seen people taken off the street because they wrote an op-ed in their college newspaper supportive of Palestinian rights. And every one of these sort of breaks down those norms, as softens people up, makes it almost seem more acceptable. And I think that's what we and what the larger media really needs to be pushing back on. And it's hard because there have been so many outrages, and it's such a constant flow of almost unthinkable incidents. But that's why it's so important that we connect the narratives, we connect the dots, and we really hold these officials accountable for these kind of changes, these kind of attacks, this kind of utter lawlessness, and credit to Senator Padilla and others, standing up in those moments, speaking out in those moments, not allowing themselves to be just simply taken away, but knowing that a lot of other people don't have that option. So when it comes to the media, when it comes to politicians, I think we really need to be looking to those in this moment who are not hiding under the table, who are not backing off, who are not pretending this is business as usual, but are actually really calling it out at every turn. That's the only thing that has turned back, authoritarians in the past, whether that's McCarthyism or what we're going through now, has been people who do have some privilege and power speaking up and speaking out, because so many people who are being targeted, by these Gestapo-like tactics don't have that ability, aren't guaranteed access to a high-priced lawyer, don't wear a suit to work. And that's really what's so harrowing about this moment, and very intentionally so by those who've taken power, where they don't necessarily have the reach and power to do everything they want to do, but every time they can take another public space and put it off limits, put somebody else in fear that speaking out or asking a question might result in them being shuffled off to some elevator and to some detainment facility and who knows where, that begins to break down a resistance that we're seeing. There's actually a lot of resistance out there, and that's the other part of the story that I think the media has done some good coverage of, but has often missed. We had 5 or 6 million people out over the weekend protesting what this administration's doing. That needs to be more than a one-day story or a couple of pictures. Mm-hmm. That really speaks to a large and growing opposition to what's happening right now. And you know, historically, the media has had a lot of interest in downplaying that kind of protest. We need to push our media outlets to actually pay attention to what's happening and all the people who are showing up who've never gone to a protest before and are now speaking out at what they see as really an intrusion and an invasion into their communities, and how much they're really trying to reject this, even as the administration itself continues to turn up the heat, continues to try to create these outrage moments to serve their ends.
Craig Aaron is president and CEO of Free Press and the Free Press Action Fund. Will Bunch is an award-winning journalist and national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. What are your thoughts? Do you think the media are meeting this moment? Where are you going for your news about what is happening? There's so much happening on a daily basis. And if you'd like to talk about Republican cuts to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, if you have any questions about what that means for public media, James Cass, executive director of KALW Public Media, will be joining us in just a few minutes. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Will, to talk more about these unprecedented times, as you point out in your column about the horrific political assassinations last week, you write, a shocking number of MAGA adherents not only skipped over any condolences for a political leader, former House Speaker Melissa Hortman, but gleefully celebrated what they thought was a eureka moment against their leftist enemies. None more shockingly than Utah Senator Mike Lee, who posted the first ominous surveillance photos of the shooter and joked about them not once but twice. He wrote, "This is what happens when Marxists don't get their way." Can you just talk about this, Will? How dangerous this is, given that political violence is on the rise in this country?
Yeah, no, I'm glad we're talking about this, because I was hoping we would bring that up, because, you know, earlier on when we were talking about the assassination itself and just the level of immorality in our politics right now, to me, the reaction was almost, I mean, the act was shocking and the reaction was also shocking. And you had a couple things in play here. One, it all starts with this phenomenon, right, where people instantly, when they hear news of some major event, like a shooting, whether it's an assassination like this or a mass shooting somewhere, people want to pin it on their ideological enemy, right? That, you know, if you're a conservative, oh, I know the liberals must have done this. I'm gonna prove that this guy was a liberal. And they start, you know, checking the person's voting registration, checking their campaign contributions, which, to be honest, can be revealing, and sometimes it's confusing and not revealing, you know. But in this case, is a perfect example of how things can be confusing. Is apparently this guy, you know, the alleged shooter was a small business person, and actually the governor before Tim Walz, I believe, was also a Democrat, but it appointed him to this very kind of innocuous, you know, workforce development commission, state commission. And when Walz came in, he just, it's a nonpartisan, non-political thing. You know, people Googled and found Tim Walz appoints this guy to a commission, and it's like, aha, he's a Democrat, he's a liberal. I knew it was a, you know, and it started this whole dialogue. And plus, you know, for a bunch of people on the right, it just gave them this kind of open season to say whatever they wanted. And, you know, here's Mike Lee, a United States Senator, with like no human empathy at all, you know, there was never even any of the, you know, kind of rote obligatory thoughts and prayers. We've totally, that seems quaint nowadays, you know. It's like, you know, he had to make these jokes about the shooter being a liberal. Of course, I mean, well, not of course, but it turned out, you know, given his targets, not really that surprising that, you know, he was not a liberal. He was conservative. He went to Trump rallies. He belonged to a conservative church that was very anti-abortion. And yet people, you know, we're in this moment where empathy is so lacking that people want to use an assassination to score points, you know, rather than just express condolences. Let the cops do their work for a couple of days, and let's see what happens. We don't do that anymore.
Well, and it's so frightening, Will, because he actually went to other homes, and some of these people were not home, luckily.
Yeah, I mean, he had a list. I forget now how many people, but he had dozens of people on a list. And I think the one thing they had all had in common was they were all pro-abortion rights people. So, you know, we think that was his issue, maybe, although he didn't leave, he didn't put out a manifesto or anything. But I guess since he's alive and he's going to go on trial, maybe we'll find out what his motivation is. But yeah, it's scary. You know, politicians are very afraid. And I think in some cases, you have to worry if whether politicians, you know, political acts, their votes and whatnot are being affected by fear. You know, you've heard, there have been some comments to that effect. You know, Lisa Murkowski, for example, who's probably the most independent Republican affiliated member of the Senate, you know, she said, well, people are afraid. You know, they're afraid of people going to their house. They're afraid of being harassed online. And you have to wonder if this is starting to affect the way some of these people vote, you know, that they don't want to rock the boat or oppose, you know, a Trump nominee or something like that, because they're afraid of violence like this.
Well, to your point, Will, we've had so many journalists on the show over the years who say Republicans say they do not like a lot of what Trump is doing, but they're afraid to stand up to him because of death threats. Zach Beauchamp had a piece in Vox last January, how death threats get Republicans to fall in line behind Trump, the insidious way violence is changing American politics. So this is connected. And we just hope that, you know, more in the media connect the dots, because as we have seen, sadly, lives are at risk. Will, what are you working on right now before we let you go?
I think my next column, because I'm running out of time, is I may actually take a break from DC politics for my next column and write about the New York City mayor's race, which is fascinating. You know, it'd be down to two finalists, which are, you know, Andrew Cuomo, who, I mean, his comeback is a little bit shocking to me. You know, it seemed like, you know, when 11 different women accused him of some sort of sexual harassment or misconduct, you know, people thought that was the end of the line for him. And now here he is back, and he's the favorite. And the more progressive community in New York is lined up behind this challenger, Zohran Mamdani, and who has a decent chance beating Cuomo. And what you're seeing now is you're seeing a lot of establishment types trying to spread fear and panic about the idea that somebody as far left as Mamdani might get elected. And I think a lot of it's unfair. So I'm going to take a look at that probably this weekend, unless God knows what else is going to happen. I mean, it's horrible to, it's not a joke or anything, but whenever I tell my editors what I'm working on, I always, almost always add the phrase barring World War III, because you just, you know, heaven forbid, you just, you know, that's a euphemism for whatever kind of crazy thing is going to happen next that you can't anticipate.
Well, thank you so much for your work, Will, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much, Rose, for having me again. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. Will Bunch is an award-winning journalist and national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's written several books, including his most recent, After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics, and How to Fix It. Coming up after a break, we'll continue speaking with Craig Aaron, president and CEO of Free Press and the Free Press Action Fund. We'll also be joined by James Cass, executive director of KALW Public Media, to talk about Republican plans to defund the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Lisa, we're about to switch gears, so we can't take your call, but Lisa wanted to say police must have badges and not masks and be held accountable for their actions. We should mention that State Senator Scott Wiener in California introduced a bill that would bar law enforcement officials from wearing masks while interacting with the public. So we will definitely continue to cover this issue in the weeks to come. Thank you for the call. We're going to talk now about after a break about efforts to defund the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So if you have any questions or comments on that, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255 or any questions for Craig Aaron or James Cass. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you are in the Bay Area, we hope you can join us for a special event tomorrow, Caregiving for Caregivers, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at our space 220 Montgomery in San Francisco. I'll be sharing my caregiving experience along with others at 1 p.m. and a number of incredible organizations will be there to talk about their services. 11 to 3 tomorrow, 220 Montgomery Street in San Francisco. Go to kalw.org and click events for more information. Now we are going to talk about longtime Republican efforts to defund the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. House Republicans voted to cut $1.1 billion from the CPB, which funds more than 1,500 public TV and radio stations across the country. Now it's up to Senate Republicans to determine whether this bill passes. We're joined by Craig Aaron, President and CEO of Free Press and the Free Press Action Fund. And now we'd like to welcome James Cass to the show. James is Executive Director of KALW Public Media. James joined KALW in August 2023. He previously served as founding Executive Director of Youth Speaks, a position he held for 21 years. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. So you have been meeting with NPR and other stations for many months now, and I understand that you just got out of a meeting with NPR. Can you give us the latest?
Yeah, so NPR, I think, has been doing a good job of gathering station leaders from across the country, and there's been about 150 to 200 of us meeting as often as twice a week for the last several months. So the newest update this morning, first, I want to just say it's important to clarify that this is a rescission bill, right? The money for 2 years of CPB funding and for 1 year of USAID funding has already been approved by the Congress. So this is the administration's attempt to pull that money back. So it's sort of outside of the normal practice. And as you said, it was passed recently by the House and now it's in the Senate. Susan Collins is the chair of the committee and they are meeting next week with the sole witness is Russell Vogt, who is the head of the OMB, and as you know from your great work around Project 2025, one of the chief architects of Project 2025. The sense from NPR is that this is good news because a couple of things could come out of it. One is it's not a vote, it's an information gathering meeting, and it allows them to actually question Russell Vogt and talk about why this rescission, this $9 billion of money saved that's sort of been tied to DOGE cuts now, is necessary and what its implications are across the country and across the globe for the USAID stuff. So two things could come out of it. One is they could decide to just move forward as it is and then move it to the floor, or Susan Collins and the group could decide that they want to put some amendments. If there are amendments added in anything for USAID, for CBB, then it has to go back to the House. The entire package has to be passed by midnight Eastern time on July 18th or 11:59 p.m. on July 18th. If it doesn't, then the rescission package fails. So the delays that could happen if there are amendments, NPR sees as good news because it would be hard with the, you know, the holiday break around July 4th and other things to meet that July 18th deadline if it has to go back to the House and then go through both houses again for a straight up and down vote. It's not a 60 vote threshold in the Senate. It's just a straight majority. So they're feeling relatively optimistic around that. They believe that there are a number of senators, even Republican senators, who have challenges with either the CPB or the USAID side, and some of them have both. But it's still up in the air. We still have no idea, so we are quite literally operating in a space where we're not sure what the future of public broadcasting looks like.
And James, to your point about what this administration, specifically Russ Vogt, is trying to do with money that is already there, Politico right. had a piece about this, and they report the Government Accountability Office says this maneuver is unlawful, and Republican lawmakers in charge of divvying up federal funding are wary that Russell Vogt is now talking about it in the open. And Senator Collins says these pocket rescissions are illegal.
Right. Well, and the pocket rescission is a different thing. So what could happen, similar to a pocket veto in some ways, although frankly, I don't know all the mechanics behind it, even if this fails, or if it's voted down, or if more likely the Senate sort of runs out the clock so that nobody has to do a tough vote, there is something called a pocket rescission, which is my understanding is that towards the end of the fiscal year, which is the end of September, the governmental fiscal year, there's some way for the Trump administration to do something called a pocket rescission, which is somehow they don't formulate the process in some way, which would essentially kill the funding. So that's been rarely used, and the legality of it is questioned. The rescission process is legal, and they're actually right now going through the process, which is again why NPR is at least somewhat buoyed in that Susan Collins and the committee are actually going through the proper channels and not just rubber stamping it, but they actually are bringing it to committee, interviewing Russell Vought. Then they will have a conversation around what the next steps are, whether it's moved to the floor, whether it stays in committee and has amendments added to it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, we really don't know, but the pocket rescission is a whole other thing. Even if we get through this, there's still the fear of the pocket rescission.
Craig, I think this just speaks to the fact that so many of us don't know the ins and outs of how government works, and this is what it ta is taking to give us a 101 on spending.
Yeah, I think that was a great description because this is part of the problem with this administration is the way they've operated is they'll keep raising the stakes. They'll say, well, we're going to do this completely unusual thing in a rescission process, but if you don't let us get away with that, maybe we'll do something even crazier. And that's how they sort of operated in the courts and a lot of other places, doing really unthinkable things. It's Congress's job to decide how the money is spent, and they've already committed this money. And the whole reason it's done in advance is because it's supposed to reduce the threats of political interference into the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and into local stations. So they're going to try all these tricks, all these moves, and essentially constantly stress test the system. You know, so much of what DOGE was in there doing, the legality was highly questionable. Under the authority was completely mysterious. But it's this approach of how much can we get away with? How much can we take a sledgehammer to these institutions, knowing even if we fail, even if it stops, we've left them more damaged, more dysfunctional than we found them. And unfortunately, they're now turning that on the public broadcasting system because part of what they recognize is the way people are going to find out about these cuts, the way they're going to find out about Project 2025 is by people who are actually out there doing reporting, actually doing shows like this, bringing on people who are paying attention to the footnotes and the things hiding in the details. That's a big reason why public media has become a target. Now they're going to throw lots of slanderous words and they're going to accuse culture war and all these language that they're going to play around with. But what it essentially comes down to is they want fewer people who they can't control paying attention to what they're doing. And it's why this is such a threat and why we need to really pay attention to this entire package and the connection between the two things. They're coming after this essential global health initiatives, you know, keeping thousands and thousands of people around the world, tens of thousands of people from dying from diseases that are treatable and curable, but only if the money is there to do it. And at the same time, they're coming after the people who are capable of covering those stories and telling people the stakes of these kind of attacks. That is not a coincidence. They see those things as very connected, and that what makes this so dangerous, which is why, you know, in California, your senators, as far as I know right now, are on the right side of this issue. But if you know people who live in states with Republican senators, they need to be hearing from their constituents. These are incredibly unpopular cuts. And I know a lot of people who do watch Washington, they hear, well, it's up to Susan Collins. Maybe she'll do the right thing this time. That is often cold comfort because they've seen nominations and other things go through. But what we have seen over many, many years of advocating for support for public media is that people have to speak out. And when Congress hears from enough of them, they have to pay attention. It doesn't take that many votes for this thing to be stopped. They only won by 2 votes in the House. It doesn't take that many votes for them to just run out the clock and not go through with this. And then, you know, we live to sort of fight another day in these larger fights over the budget. But this has become a time where those in power have recognized just how much power they have when they can mess around with these processes, when they can get in and exploit the data and do all the things that Doge did. And they're going to get away with as much as they can until people rise up and say, no, we're not going to take it. We expect you to vote no on this. And this is one of those fights that is winnable, that potentially snowballs into other fights that actually send a clear message to Congress that their job is not to carry out the wishes of Project 2025. Their job is supposed to be actually representing their constituents. And that's something that unfortunately Congress has lost track of here in the early months of the Trump administration.
Craig Aaron is president and CEO of Free Press and the Free Press Action Fund. James Cass is executive director of KALW Public Media. We are talking about Republican efforts to cut funding for public media and what that would mean. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. James, if this went through, what would this mean for KALW? How are you preparing? And what are you hearing from other public radio stations?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. Let's start with the other stations, because it's been an up and down, you know, truly like a roller coaster of emotions and of information. Like not that long ago, it seemed as though the reason why the rescission package wasn't being moved forward was because there were not the votes for the House to move it forward. The tying it to the Doge cuts sort of changed the dynamic a little bit where they could at least claim some victory. So that's, you know, been troubling for some. You know, the fact of the matter is there are public media stations, TV and radio in every market, in every district across the country, including rural and red areas. For a lot of those stations, CPB accounts for 50 to 60% of their budget. So many of them are truly in survival mode, where a number of rural stations whose primary, you know, they're of course, local journalism happens, but they're true civic institutions in their community. They provide true information around like farming reports, weather reports, tide reports, their community gathering places. They're the only places where there's access to local journalism in any regard. They're like true civic institutions. A lot of them would be gone overnight. Like they just do not have the resources to make it. They just don't. You know, we're not necessarily in that place. CPB, in all transparency, gives us about $400,000 a year. That's a lot of money. It would not kill KALW. And we're fortunate we have supporters across the Bay Area who believe in the work we do. But it would make us make some very difficult decisions, particularly in regard to our ability to do direct community engagement programs, invest in local journalism, invest in our next generation of journalists that we work with through our Audio Academy program. So it really changed for 2 years the total, frankly, our ability to truly engage with some of the most crucial issues that take place here in the Bay Area. We're not yet sure what it would mean in relationship to NPR programming, but one of the things that CPB does the licensing for music. So all the interstitials you hear between programs and all the local music programming we do, you know, our DJs at nights and on the weekends, our variety of music programs, all of that is in danger of disappearing overnight because we would not have access to license that. And we couldn't afford to do individual licensing agreements with all the different music producers. So, you know, both on the journalism side, the community engagement side, and on the music side, it would really change the entire field of public media, and it would absolutely devastate some of our core work.
Hmm. And to your point, James, about small stations, the New York Times' Megan Marino and Katie Edmondson had a really good piece about rural communities and how they would be affected. Senator Mike Rounds, Republican of South Dakota, said we're taking a look primarily because of Native Americans that live in some of the most poorest counties in the United States. They rely on having that one lone radio station within their region that keeps them all informed as to weather emergencies and so forth. Jack Jones, acting manager of KGVA in Montana, he says their broadcast plays a vital role on the Fort Belknap Indian Reservation. He said, we're in a rural area. A lot of areas do not have cell service. A lot of people rely on the radio to get much of their information. They put out emergency alerts for food and for floods and fires, information on child support programs. And this is such an important point, James. It's so easy for those of us in the Bay Area. I mean, we've got three stations. We're very lucky here. But in some of these places, they don't even have cell phone service. And that's what they rely on, is their radio station to get crucial information.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Rose, because one of the critical things that CPB funds and that public media stations do across the country is the emergency broadcast. And we are, you know, when there was a typhoon warning not that long ago, KLW has a contract with the city and with the state to be a part of the emergency broadcast system. So that's a really critical service. It's actually tied in with FEMA, but the money comes from CPB and is part of the rescission package.
Craig, what would you like to add here? I think this gets lost in the conversation. I mean, to think that, you know, there are people right now, Native Americans, who do not have cell service. These stations are a lifeline for them.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And it's true in so many places throughout the South, throughout Appalachia, throughout California, where your public media station, where so much media has disappeared with the collapse of commercial media. And yes, it includes journalism, but it also just includes basic community information, especially in an emergency. These stations are essential. But, you know, I sort of want to step back and say, how are we in this moment of so much need for more local voices, more local coverage, more ability to make sense of the world? The idea that it would be a that the government would be making it a priority, going completely out of bounds to try to take apart a system that, frankly, it's already been starving. And we need more investment in public media. We shouldn't be forcing these kind of existential choices on these stations. We should be reinforcing them. A station like KLW shouldn't be having to figure out where is it going to try to find another $400,000. We need to be investing in these institutions because so much of our local voices and local media have disappeared, and it is essential to our democracy. And like we can't make the mistake. The reason that they're coming after public media is because authoritarians understand. If you talk to people in the Philippines, if you talk to people in Hungary, they came after the media infrastructure because they know that's where people can actually find out what they're doing. And we know all around the world, the healthiest democracies fund public media at times that are 10, 50, 100 times per capita what we do in the United States. I'm not saying we have to increase funding 100 times, but the idea that we're not talking about shoring up our local media infrastructure in a moment like this, where we need so much help making sense of what's the truth, what's the onslaught of information. We need to be investing in our public media system, supporting our public media system. And even though I've sometimes been a critic of the larger public media system, I recognize that we have to stand up now. We have to unite, save this public media system if we're going to have any chance of building the kind of, you know, full public media system that we really need to become the leading democracy that we are capable of being. Investing in non-commercial media, in public media, in local media is essential to making that happen. And so this is one of those lines in the sand where we need to expect our elected representatives, whatever party they're part of, to say no, to say this has gone too far, to say that we shouldn't be rolling back money that has been committed. We should actually be supporting the kind of essential programming, emergency programming, educational programming that actually gives people the news and information they need to participate in a democracy. Our goal must be supporting and sustaining that democracy. And this, right now, between now and July 18th, is one of those big tests.
And as you know, Craig, per capita, the United States spends far less on public media than other countries. I mean, far less.
It's $2 per capita, something like that. Maybe two and a half. You know, a cup of coffee is what we're talking about per person. If it was $5 per capita, we would have such an amazingly robust public media system with greater reach, with more reporters, with more people represented on the airwaves. And the public media system is the only corner of our media system that it's not just about clicks. It's not just about serving the majority of the population. It actually is the media system that allows us to cover things that otherwise would go uncovered, to see that people and the beautiful, diverse communities of our cities and our entire country actually represented on the airwaves. For $2, it's nothing. And yet they're even coming for that. And I think that really lays out just how dangerous this is, because it's what stops coverage of what they're doing, but it also breaks those community bonds, like James was talking about, where your public media station, whether you're in a big city like San Francisco or in a very rural place, that is actually what connects us at our community, is going on, hearing local music, hearing local accents, hearing from someone who's sitting at a microphone who knows the names of the streets and knows what the different neighborhoods are. That's what we need to be investing in. I would argue we need to be investing a lot more, but let's start by not making a terrible mistake and cutting back on what we have, because that will be devastating for those communities and only send things in a media system that's already struggling, only send things in a worse direction.
Eileen writes in, how much does coverage depend on ownership? The media used to be the fourth estate, and now it's owned by people who have four estates. James, that is not the case for public media. And that is why, I mean, public media is important for so many reasons. But can you talk in our remaining minute and a half or so just about what Aaron just said? Public media plays such a crucial role in covering communities and at the same time also meeting this political moment. I mean, the coverage is just so broad. Can you talk about that in our final minute?
Yeah, I would just like to say that, you know, as you mentioned, I just started less than 2 years ago. The thing that has impressed me most about KLW, and I've been a 30-year listener, but is the commitment to actually working in multiple different communities to develop journalists who represent those communities. So we have a mix of seasoned folks like you who've been doing it for years, as well as the folks who's for the first time, they're hearing their voice, they're hearing their community, they're hearing their story, they're hearing their issue represented properly in the air, on the airways. That's a really critical, important thing that public media does. Public media, when it's at its best, truly represents the communities in which they exist, which is what Craig was saying, right? Like, we have folks who understand what corner, being at 16th and Valencia, what that means, what it means to be in East Oakland, what it means to be in Richmond or Daly City or wherever. That's really, really important, because it means you are asking people to become better informed, to bring their issues, to inform others about the place we all call home. And hopefully by doing so, we inspire people to act on behalf of those places to make a more just and equitable and just a more positive future for everybody involved. There is a national action team that anybody who is interested in protecting public media can join. It's protectmypublicmedia.org. You can sign up there and you can get all the information about how to reach out to your own representatives. Or as Craig was saying earlier, if you have folks who are more Republican states or have Republican representation, there's all the tools for you to reach out to them to ask them to get in touch with their representatives as soon as possible. This is something that's happening right now. And whether it's around public media or on foreign aid, this is the time. These next 2 weeks are really critical for the future of these programs.
Thank you. ProtectOurPublicMedia.org.
Protect my public media.
Protect my public media. ProtectMyPublicMedia.org. James Cass is executive director of KALW Public Media. Craig Aaron is president and CEO of Free Press and the Free Press Action Fund. James and Craig, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.